Welcome to the Tapped In podcast, a production of Bellingham Tap Trail. Tapped In covers the people, news, and events in and around the Bellingham craft beer scene. I'm Dave Morales, and I'll be your host for today's episode. Today's guest is Aaron Jacob Smith. While you may not know him, you know him. He's the head brewer at Boundary Bay and has played in numerous bands around town and the world. We just sat around for a couple of hours over a few mini beers and let the tape run. Enjoy. Aaron Jacob Smith, how's it going?
It's going fantastic. It's good to see you, Dave.
You as well. Tell us a bit about yourself. What drew you to beer? I mean, because you've been brewing at Boundary now. I mean, you were there when I was there 20 years ago, and you're still there running the show. So I've known you since you were, you'd been brewing for a while, I think, by the time you were in Bellingham and working there. But just talk a bit about the beginning of your homebrewing adventures.
Wow. Okay. This is where the portion of the evening's programming where I get to talk about myself.
Yeah. Oh, it's
well,
all going to be
fun.
Talking about yourself.
Okay. Well,
I just edit out the things that I talk about.
I was born at a very young age and grew up as a child. And then eventually I got really, really thirsty by about the age of 16. And I think that's about when I started drinking a good amount of beer. I had a friend's dad who would buy us beer, and we bought chicken, and we would watch the Tuesday night fights on ESPN, and it was a great time. I looked forward to every Tuesday, and we drank a lot of bad beer, black yeah. label.
Oh, yeah.
We called it the Sapporo of Canada, and then we drank Stroh's. And then I think we discovered Kokanee and Labatt's, and we thought that was pretty good in comparison. I never, ever liked any of the big three, Coors, Miller, Budweiser. Mm. Never really liked them. For some reason, I thought the even worse possible beers were better than those three
yeah.
for some reason. But then after this Canadian Labatt's and Kokanee's, we discovered some of the micro brews that were coming out a long time ago. I think there was Red Hook and like Nor'easter and Grant's and Rogue. And that's when I really started to fall in love with beer. About that time, I was around 18, moved to Bellingham from Spokane when I was 19, and had, well, probably incriminating the co-op here, but a lady who didn't know I wasn't of age. And I would go and I would buy just one of any beer that I had never had before. And that was about the time I had a friend who taught me to homebrew, and when I saw what the ingredients were and the process was, I had the revelation, you know, the epiphany was that I could taste the difference in the malt and the hops,
mm-hmm.
and that was huge. And then it just started this whole quest of discovery for flavor, and I tried all the beers I could get my hands on and was homebrewing probably awful beer. I just aged it in my dresser in bottles. You know, I didn't have an extra refrigerator for it
right,
or anything
yeah.
or a carbon dioxide tank to purge any of the, bottles
you
with or anything.
Beer.
And at the time, I was working at Cicchetti's making pizza. And that was between the Up and Up Tavern and the 3B Tavern. And there was an open window to the 3B Tavern. And I became friends with all the bartenders there. That was just a great time of my life. I was having fun, hearing lots of rock and roll bands I would never get to hear, being underage, you know, on the other side of the wall. So then I turned 21 and got to go, oh, we're talking about rock and roll now. I get easily sidetracked.
Yeah.
Basically, the Cicchetti's moved from that location, and they opened the pool hall, and I no longer liked it as much.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied at what was Cellophane Square then, where Everyday Music is now, and I applied at Boundary Bay, and I got an interview for both, and I was at Boundary Bay having a beer. I believe it was a pint of Scotch ale, and really excited that the next day I got to go have an interview at Cellophane Square. Maybe I would get to work in a music store.
Mm-hmm.
And the dishwasher at Boundary Bay didn't show up. And Adam, who used to work at the North Fork as a cook, worked at Boundary Bay in the kitchen. And he said, "Did you still want a job here?" And I said, "Yes." And he goes, "Washing dishes?" And I said, "Sure."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Put on an apron."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, can I finish my beer? And he said, no. So I looked at the beer, wondered if I could get by with having another drink, decided to push it away, went into the kitchen, put on an apron, and the rest is sort of a history for me.
So, yeah, I mean, I remember, I've heard most of that before, but, you know, you were talking about the beers that you were slowly learning things. One of the questions I usually ask, it's usually later, but since you started off with it, is there just a single beer that you can remember that flipped the switch? When you drank it, you were like, I need to know how to make this. Or was it just more of a general, I like beer and I want to be able to make beer?
That's a great question. And I do remember.
Yeah.
At the time,
Most brewers do.
At the time, I was drinking a lot of German lagers. They came in the pint 0.9 bottles.
Mm-hmm.
I liked them for home brewing. Good size, kind of a consistent shape. You know, like Eyinger. But the one beer that I had that just blew my mind that I absolutely had to make was Sierra Nevada's Bigfoot Barley Wine Style Ale.
Hmm.
Love it. It's always been one of my favorites. It's the quintessential American style barley wine and probably the forefather of an Imperial IPA. It's just too dark, but it's got the hops.
Yeah. Yeah, if you drink it young, it was the first thing that I remember seeing like 100 plus IBUs, but you couldn't, if you were drinking it a few years later, dissipated quite a bit.
Yeah, it was balanced.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I still, Sierra Nevada is one of my favorite breweries.
Yeah, they're great. Their Celebration is a wonderful winter ale, and I don't really drink a lot of winter ales.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just a little darker IPA. It's just got some C60 in it, really, and that's what sets it apart.
There used to be a bar in Spokane called the Viking Tavern. And it was great. They had tons of good beer on draft in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go and get a big Belgian Thunderfish. And it was a blend of four beers. It was Bigfoot was the big. The Belgian was Merit Sioux 8. The fish was Leviathan. And I can't remember what the thunder was, but it was just fun.
That's crazy.
The guy there just loved beer. I forgot the owner's name. They might be reopening again soon. I heard a rumor, but I don't live in Spokane, and I don't have to, so.
I haven't been to Spokane in a long, long time.
It's a lot nicer than it used to be.
Yeah. Do you remember the first batch of beer that you made?
I do.
Yeah. Was it here, or were you still in Spokane? Or
was in my apartment up on off Lakeway, off St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Doppelbock with ale yeast.
Yeah. Doppelbock style. You know,
dark ale, strong dark ale. Yeah. Made lots of strong dark ales.
Nice. Did it go, was it all grain, or did you start with the extract?
No, I did extracts for...
Like, but with the grain in a bag, kind of like partial mash deal, or was it...
Yeah, I had the bag. Yeah, you buy like the cans of syrup and then you have a little bit of real grain.
Yeah, all your specialty grains, all your crystal and stuff like that.
There used to be a place over where Orchard Street was. Now there's the Jekyll and Hyde restaurant.
Yeah.
And there used to be a brew on premises place. And that was the homebrew shop before Robert Arzu opened the North Corner Brew Supply over where the State Farm Insurance place is over on Elm and Northwest. And so I went there and I wanted to make, you know, I was working up to the Bigfoot and I was like, I'm going to make this beer. And I wanted 4 ounces of hops for my 5 gallon batch. 4 ounces of hops, Dave.
Yeah.
This was a lot of hops back in 1996. And you know what? He wouldn't sell it to me.
What?
He wouldn't. No, he refused. He said, I won't sell you that much. It's too much. And I said, that's what I want. He wouldn't sell it to me. And I went away feeling like... I didn't get to do that. It's like someone not selling you an amp. Like, it's too loud for you.
Yeah, yeah. You can't play this 12-string guitar.
Well, I couldn't tune that 12-string guitar.
Right, yeah. It's funny because when Eric and I were talking, Eric Jorgensen, he was talking about that same shop, which I don't remember. I think, you know, I didn't go to the homebrew shop until a little while later, but Robert was one of the first people I met in town. And I actually just saw him today. I was like, you know, I got to interview you for this as well.
You should.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm going to. But Eric had this great story about how he was underage and like going to buy ingredients at that same shop. I just remember him saying, like, I was very sure that hops were just hops. I just need the hops. There weren't varieties of hops. It was just hops. But yeah, he had a great story about that place too, but nothing like they wouldn't sell it to him.
I would go back and visit my parents in Spokane, and they had a place on, I believe, Division? Maybe it was Monroe. It was called Jim's 5 Cent Homebrew. And it's been there forever. I might have been there in the 80s.
Huh.
And that was kind of a cool place.
5 Cent Homebrew. When Steph and I moved back to Traverse City, Michigan, back in 2004, the only homebrew shop in town was a homebrew shop / hat shop.
Haberdashery and hops?
Pretty much. It was ridiculous.
I remember when we wouldn't sell me the hops, pretty soon after that, Robert opened up, and I went there so much that I remember he told me that I was his best customer. He'd only been open about 3 months, and I probably had brewed like 6 batches, and so I maybe had earned that, but I was very flattered. He let me watch his store once when he was out of town.
Nice.
That was a big compliment. He said, there's 5 gallons in the kegerator. Drink as much as you want. And I thought, okay.
Well, that 5 gallons is dead.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I remember that little place. He's been at the place down on Central across from Jalapenos now for a long time, like 10 plus years, probably 12 years or something.
Yeah, I haven't gone in for quite a while.
So you were doing extract batches for a while. How long did it take you before you got into all grain? Like, when did you turn that corner?
Okay, I think I started brewing extract when I was 19. And so I didn't turn 21 until 1996. And I had been brewing all grain for a good 3 years by the time I started at Boundary in 1998.
Okay.
So I did a few years of extract. And then once I discovered the all grain brewing, I went down to Z Recycling and got a couple Sankey kegs and drilled a couple holes in and used the Sawzall and went through a few bits, cutting the tops out, and bought the little stainless steel mesh and made the two-part system and did that at least every 2 weeks. I think I was pushing a batch out for
nice. I remember you homebrewing back then, but I don't think I ever saw your system. I mean, you know, of course we were hanging out in a brewery all day, so.
It was fun. I think by comparison now with the way that everyone's become so much more educated, it would just be embarrassing compared to even like a beginner system now.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, I mean, it's a very real thing. You know, the average competence level of home brewers these days is nuts. It's crazy. The days of just talking your way into, I make good beer at home. You want to hire me for your brewery? They're done. You know, people are like looking at Siebel and stuff like that as college. I'm just going to go learn how to make awesome beer, and then I'm going to go make beer.
Yeah. It's huge.
Yeah. It never occurred to me to go.
I remember when you were at Boundary Bay and Skip was at Boundary Bay way before I was brewing, and I was just washing kegs. I'd just gotten into the cellar, and I'd have one day I had you both over, and I had about 5 different kinds of homebrew,
I wanted to
present them to you, and I knew that some of them were not good, and I wanted you both to tell me what you were tasting in them. And I remember there was one, and Skip's eyes just opened up huge. He goes, I think it's super oxidized. And it did. It just tasted like sucking on a wet cardboard box.
I remember that day. Yeah. I remember all of your stuff. I do remember seeing the system now. It was tucked back in that back room on the Lincoln Street house by your washer and dryer and stuff. It's all coming back to me.
Yeah. And then there was a couple good ones, though. I want my redemption here, though. One of the ones I do remember was one of the best things I had ever homebrewed. It was, well, I'll just tell the story, that I was driving from Boise, Idaho to Bellingham through Spokane. And somewhere along the road in like North Idaho, there was like this roadside peach stand. And we stopped there, and they had like this blowout prices on these overripe peaches. Like, you would hold the peach in your hand, and it was so ripe, it would just sort of like ooze just down with gravity to, yeah. and just juice itself holding in your hand. So I had all these towels mm-hmm. and got a box they gave me. And I like wrapped all these peaches and all these towels and put them in these boxes and drove to Bellingham. And then I made a Sizer mm-hmm. Braggot. And
I remember that drink.
It was good.
I definitely remember that.
And so I took apple juice as the medium instead of water, put in a bunch of raspberry honey and some malt extract, and then pitted and seeded all of these peaches and made this wonderful carbonated peach colored beverage. And it was wonderful.
It was amazing.
Really strong.
It was amazing. I remember you bringing it in and you're like, you got to try this. And yes, it was very strong, but it was just, it had so much going on, but it wasn't busy. It was just well layered. Yeah. I remember that. That's the main thing that I remember of your homebrew that I tried.
I think it was because the honey was fermenting a little slower and we bottled it too early. Oh. A couple bottles exploded.
Then my honey
roommate,
doesn't stop.
Matt Z, and I looked at each other and I was like, dude, we got to drink this shit. And we got so excited. And there was like just a couple cases of it. So we drank that up pretty quick because you can't have bottles exploding.
No, it's a safety hazard. So speaking for myself, and I I have this theory that brewers tend to be pretty detail oriented, and so I'm just wondering what your thoughts on that are. I have been to breweries that are filthy, you know, where there's like gunks.
Yeah, I mean, brewing is like 90% cleaning, really. I mean, you go to a brewery and it's sort of should be like a hospital, you know. It's mm-hmm. very clean. It always has that certain smell of all the chemicals, and
yeah.
unless there's a process happening that overwhelms that smell with malt and yeah. mash. And
it was there a point, so you were brewing a whole bunch of stuff, you know, you said you were pumping out a whole bunch, was there one point where you suddenly were able to step back and you're like, I'm not bad at this? I mean, was there a point where your skill set jumped noticeably to where you're like, oh, huh, I could do this, you know, for money?
Yeah, I had lost my girlfriend and I didn't have anything better to do. Mm. And I started brewing a lot. So you could say I fell in love.
Aww,
so beer sweet. Is my rebound.
Yeah. I like that. Do you remember the first beer that you ever drank?
Yeah. I didn't like it.
Yeah. It's funny.
Well, you know, shit. There's a few beers that were the first. I think I remember being really young and just grabbing a can of open Stroh's
mm-hmm.
and taking a belt off of it. And I thought, oh, this is awful. But I think I was like 7.
Yeah.
You know, the same off of like my stepdad's cigarette. And he's like, you know, back when you'd smoke in the house and he'd say, mm-hmm. hey, can you put this out? And I was like walking outside, go around the corner and I'm like, have a little puff off, probably just the filter.
Yeah,
at that point.
Yeah,
I'm like, my God, this is awful. Why would anyone do this? Same kind of thing. Yeah. But I do remember the first beer that I felt freedom when I drank it. And unfortunately, I had to share it because we were in early junior high and we stole it out of my friend's father's refrigerator. But it was in Salmon, Idaho, and we were just camping in our sleeping bags out in the backyard on a hot summer night. And it was Buckhorn, and it had an elk on it, kind of like Schmidt looks, but it was Buckhorn.
Yeah.
And just some crappy, you know, American lager. We just split that, and there was something about the stars overhead, and, you know, we weren't in the house, and no one could tell us when to go to sleep, and, you know, I was probably in 5th grade by then or something.
Yeah.
And that was good. Then my father let me have a beer when I was in junior high, a little later junior high.
And yeah, those were back in the days when that was okay.
Yeah, you weren't, well, you weren't a bad parent. I'd always been able to have a small glass of wine, you know, with dinner starting at like age 10 with my father. And that was good. He wanted me to respect alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I really appreciate that because, you know, if you never drink more than me, you'll never have a problem. But he let me pick the one I wanted. And I think I had a choice between Singha and Guinness. And I just liked the Guinness. I was like, it was dark. I'd never had a dark beer.
Yeah.
And it was too syrupy for me. And I didn't really like it. So then he let me switch with him and I drank the Singha. And I think I liked that a lot more. And then after that, I think the learning curve of drinking beer just sort of came from drinking those bad beers that you drink in high school, just kind of for the effect and because you're with your friends. And then it really did just take that process, like I said earlier, of drinking better beer that had good flavor, and then eventually being able to analyze what those flavors were and appreciating them for the ingredients. And then just, you know, it was like cuisine at that point.
Right. Yeah. When you're not just desperately drinking the beer because it's there and you can slow down and be like, okay, wait, what is this? What's going on here?
Yeah. Indian food's like that. You know, I was always overwhelmed by Indian food. I was like intimidated by it. And then I realized it's like the same five spices. It's just this one doesn't have cardamom, or this one doesn't have anise, or doesn't have clove, or more of these. Just this different titrations of these, you know, five spices for the most part. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it has tomato in the sauce or not, you know. So when you appreciate that, you know, you just taste what it is, and it's a subtle difference. And
yeah,
I like them all.
Yeah, you get into the subtleties at that point.
There's no beer that I really don't like. Although, I don't really get the whole East Coast hazy IPA.
Well, I was going to ask you about what your thoughts are in different, because different regions have different styles that they like. You know, like every time I go back to the East Coast, and even just as far as Michigan, the beers are definitely more malt forward.
That's great. And
they are a little sweeter. Like you can tell that it's, generally speaking, mash at higher temperatures and stuff. Do you have any, I mean, I know obviously you're partial to the West Coast beers, but even when I go south, you know, they tend to be lighter, more lawnmower beers because it's
hotter.
It's 100 degrees down there.
And I do think the East Coast can make some great beer.
Oh, they make great beers. It's just, it's a different.
There's a trend, and it's coming to the West Coast now.
It's different flavors.
It's a style.
Yeah, but that's just one. I mean, I'm talking more just in general. They just tend to be more.
I'm all
more
for
malt
a better
forward.
Balance of beer. Malt forward is great.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've really appreciated seeing in the post-IPA hop bomb palate blasting fad that lasted a really long time that we all had
years.
To get out
yeah.
of our system that was fine. It was mm-hmm. growing pains. Was that now we have these. Well, kind of an understanding of just the way brewing works, you know, the chemistry, and that you actually get a lot more IBUs out of those late hop additions than anyone ever realized.
Yeah.
You know, you can add no bittering hops and add a bunch of hops, cut the boil, and it'll have plenty of IBUs in it. So I think we're going to get a lot of miles out of that for having better balanced beers.
Yeah.
And I'm loving all of the sours that we're having because with that low pH,
mm-hmm.
those kettle sours, they're just so tart and tangy and, you know, great mouthfeel.
Yeah, I know. I like sours.
If I'm making a screwdriver or a Bloody Mary, I like a good squeeze of lemon or lime in there. Just give it that kind of acidity and
mm-hmm.
really opens it up a lot.
It makes things spot. And even in cooking, you know, like you add acidity to something and all of a sudden that and a little bit of salt and it pops.
Agreed.
Do you have a favorite? I know you brew all kinds of beers, but do you have a favorite that you like to make? Is it still barley wine? You were talking about the Bigfoot earlier.
I haven't homebrewed for years.
Yeah, but I mean, even a Boundary, like, is there a beer that when you brew it, you're like, fuck yeah, I'm brewing this beer today?
You know, it probably has less to do with beers that I love to drink and beers that I just don't brew as often, maybe because it's just something different,
mm-hmm.
but it's kind of the same. I mean, it's milling it in. It's like, well, so much of this, so many bags of this, so many scoops of this, hop additions. Like, when do I do it? Maybe some of the beers that I like a lot are beers that are not as fun to brew because they're just like, I have to weigh out all the hops ahead of time because it's got like just all these late hop additions 5 minutes apart and I don't have time to run around and find. I'm going to make sure that they're ready when I have to add them to the kettle. So I'm labeling these
buckets. Your mise en place.
Yeah, my mise en place, my mise en hops. You know, I don't know. Pilsners are always fun. Lagers. You get to go and change the temperature every day to ramp it down and things like that. You know, I don't know. It's a more process. You get to taste it along like the way. You can appreciate how they change as they age. And barrel-aged beers are really fun because they do age, and you don't know how they're going to age.
Yeah, it's always a wild card.
Mystery
a little bit.
In every cask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's your favorite style to drink? If you had one desert island beer, what would that beer be?
God, it's a hot desert, right? Probably a
pilsner. Yeah.
Unless there's not a lot of food, then an IPA maybe. I don't know. I think my two favorite beers are probably pilsner and IPA.
Yeah.
I love the clean, crisp, refreshing pilsner. To me, a pilsner is beer. If you say the word beer, you just think pilsner.
Yeah.
Traditionally. But IPA, you know, a good balanced IPA with enough malt to not have it just be thin and hoppy has always sort of been my favorite beer to drink, because I like a lot of flavor. Like I said, like an Indian food and things with flavor. I like my rock and roll fast, hard, loud, rude, and aggressive. I like my food spicy, and I like my beer very flavorful. Pilsner and IPA.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Nice. Yeah, there's no right or wrong answer. That's the best part.
Yeah, I've been asked that question a lot. They're like, what's your favorite drink or what's your favorite beer? And I'm like, I've come up with so many different answers. You know what my favorite beer is? I've got three. The first one, because it's so refreshing and I just wanted that beer. I looked forward to it all day. And then my other favorite beer is probably the fifth one, because even if I'm alone, it's still a party. And then my other favorite beer is the second to last, because after that one, damn it, I know there's at least one more. That's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Nice. Yeah, that's a solid answer for sure.
Mary said too, I believe.
What's your guilty pleasure? What's the beer that you have to like, or the drink? It can be anything.
Oh, man. Alcoholic. I just usually drink shamelessly. Guilty pleasure. See, I've changed my favorite drink recently, but that's a totally different question.
Mm-hmm.
Guilty pleasure.
Well, you can answer that too, but I would... Inquiring minds would like to know what your guilty pleasure is as far as drink.
Shit, I don't... I do know.
Okay.
I've got an answer for you, Dave. Pinot Grigio.
All right.
I just got out of a really long relationship with a very old friend, and God, she just drank tons of Pinot Grigio. And I always liked white wine.
Mm-hmm.
Vance Johnson, the old wine.
Yeah, right.
We drank thousands and thousands of dollars of wine with that one. Oh my gosh, bless his soul, Vance. He turned me on to like really good white wine. And I was like, oh, you know, I mean, now you can drink rosé and not feel ashamed, because it's some great rosés.
I like rosés. Yeah.
But I drank, you know, lots of Pinot Grigio. I don't really like Chardonnays. I don't think the oaked for white is that good. I like stainless. Yeah. I like it crisp and clean. Listen to the lyrics to Chardonnay by Mudhoney. Very, very good song. Right. I mean, speaking of Vance Wilbur Johnson, he had me out to lunch once. We went to, was it called Tivoli.
And
I call it like my $5,000 lunch or something, because we drank a 1982 Mouton Rothschild Bordeaux and a 1982 Chateau Margaux Bordeaux. And this was, I don't know, it was only like 10 years ago. It was right before he died. I remember the dinner he had where we went, and we started out with a couple of like 1978 white wines, which was incredibly old for a white wine. And they were still good. They were very, you know, malty as far as wine goes. It's probably not a proper wine descriptor. And then we had some Barbarescos from 74 and 76, I believe. And then I don't know what some of the end ones were. I don't remember, but it was like, I think 9 people at the dinner, and there was 9 bottles of wine. And then one of those dinners we finished with Aquavit.
Yeah.
And that did not treat me well. I remember vomiting a lot of pickled herring and Aquavit. That was not good. But it's, you know, it's just a big spit, really. Can't be afraid of the big spit if you're going to be a brewer. It's true. Although I'm proud to say, I don't think I've had a big spit for a few years.
Yeah, all of mine have been food related. Apparently, I can't eat mussels anymore.
Oh, it must.
Yeah, bologna roll up. It turned on me. I think that was the roundabout way of. I had asked you what your guilty pleasure was, and you said
Pinot Grigio.
But then you had alluded to something else, and I don't remember what it was.
There's a local place used to be where the wild garlic. Uh-huh. Over by the courthouse, and it's called The Real McCoy.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
One of my favorite drinks is just the Manhattan.
If I could only have one drink for the rest of my life, like boozy drink,
yeah, that would be my desert island hard alcoholic drink.
Yeah.
And they recommended that I try what they called their Manhattan with Amaro. Amaro is like an Italian liqueur.
Mm-hmm.
Fernet Branca, I believe, is a style of Amaro.
Mm-hmm.
And they called it their Black Manhattan. Anyways, there's a lot of different Amaros out there. And I like to try Manhattan with Amaro instead of bitters. And it's wonderful. I really do like the deep herbal flavor balanced with the good bourbon. Tend to lean towards rye sometimes mm-hmm. when I go that direction. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, I'm a fan of perfect Manhattans. I like the balance in it because I don't like them too sweet.
One of the things I like about a Manhattan is it's sort of an antithesis to a like gin martini.
Mm-hmm.
When you want your Beefeater gin martini up and dry, it should probably taste exactly the same whenever you have it, wherever you have it, whoever makes it.
Mm-hmm.
But Manhattan of this order, they run the gamut and they vary a lot. And I do like that variance. It gets a lot of just fun having something different each time.
Yeah, I know. It's so fun to put different things together. And I rarely do it on a home level. I just have a good rye and then just the Dolan dry and sweet.
The legendary James Guzman moved down to
Tacoma.
Yeah, he right says that they make Bloody Marys different down there. Instead of having a big pint glass with all kinds of fucking salad and burgers and shit coming
tropical
out of it.
Tropical rainforest.
That like you just get it in like basically a bucket glass and you can almost see through it and you only need one. And I was like, I like that because that's the way I make them at home. I don't put all that shit into it. It's just, but it needs that acidity, that little lemon squeeze, a little lime. Yeah. And I definitely, the only way you can really ruin a Bloody Mary is too much Worcestershire. I don't want to drink a glass of alcoholic steak sauce.
You know? Right. Yeah. I like horseradish. I like them a little spicy too. I'm generally, it's not a drink that I go to very much. I used to make it when I was camping a lot, but I don't really do that anymore.
I like them anytime. Unless I'm at work. I never drink at work.
Of course not. That would be wrong. So, speaking of breweries and everything that's going on, what's your take on the current state of affairs? Like, what do you...
You mean having a brewery every three blocks?
Starbucks
in the mid-90s?
Well, I mean but the bigger picture of it, just what's going on and where you think it might be going. Do you think there's any warnings out there? I mean, like, what's your take on everything that's going on?
Probably no longer a really original idea to find an abandoned warehouse, turn it into a micro brew pub, and then feature like six different kinds of overhopped pale ales,
mm-hmm.
feature them in some sort of sampler and bored out holes on repurposed oak pallets and served as a sampler. No, I'm just kidding. I think it's fantastic. Everyone who likes beer, that wants to drink beer, should drink good beer. Everyone who wants to make beer should make beer. There's plenty of room for everyone.
Yeah.
And the market will figure it out. And I think it's great that as long as Budweiser exists, there should still be microbrew pubs opening up.
Cheers to that. What do you think? I mean, with all of this explosive growth happening, I was up in Anchorage at the Barley Wine Festival in January and just kind of realized I was talking to Paul Gatza from the Brewers Association, asked him the same question. And he was like, well, it's nuts right now. There's two breweries opening a day in the United States.
Wow.
And it's not slowing down. At some point, it's going to have to slow down. Jorgensen and I were talking about the shakedowns that are coming. You know, there was the one in the 90s, but that was more about quality.
And there'd be like two breweries in a town and people like, oh, there's too many. Yeah. We can't open another. Now that no one knows what the limit is.
Yeah.
The threshold is unknown.
I know people are like, got nine breweries here. Like, we're totally saturated. I'm like, no, we're not. There's neighborhoods that are completely untouched. I'm a firm believer that it's more hyper local. It's for the neighborhood. You walk here, come show up, and then you go home. I think there's probably going to be a shakedown coming in the next few years, if it hasn't already begun. And it's going to be a quality shakedown.
You think?
I think so.
People have that?
I think there's still a lot of mediocre beer out there.
You don't think that it's marketing, the brand with the fancy label that people really like? Graphic design goes a long way.
It's true.
And if people are told something's good and then they think it's good, then it's good.
Yeah.
And there's actually nothing wrong with that, really, because like in the industry, it's like, well, what kind of music do you like? Well, the music I like to listen to. Well, there you go.
You know. It's all subjective.
And to me, a lot of it's like, oh, that I didn't even know that was music. So I don't know. I don't really know if it's going to be quality. I think for the people who know it will be quality, some people might just drink beer because it's strong.
I think the Boundary Scotch Ale is definitely one of those.
It's got endurance. That beer is more popular than ever right now.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, well, it was the bill payer then, and then IPAs started happening.
That was
the
flagship, and then the IPA became the flagship, and now it's pretty balanced, I think, between...
Wow. Interesting.
I mean, we definitely brew more IPA, but the Scotch is hugely popular. There is a backbone to loyalty for that beer.
Yeah.
There's places that have that on tap that would not give it up. They sell a lot of it.
It's not my thing. Like, it was not my favorite beer of Boundaries. And it's still not. You know, not that it was a bad beer. Like, I was never ashamed of it. But
no,
it's like,
beer.
I don't want to drink it.
We were talking about some of those beers that have, like, the higher mash temperatures. There was a couple old school Northwest breweries that did that, too. And those beers were not my favorite before I even knew what it was I didn't like about them. It was that higher mash temperature.
Yeah.
I just don't really prefer a lot of residual sugar.
Right.
And so if I want a maltier beer, I think I would prefer that it came from like the yeast and less hops and the perceived maltiness instead of like actual just residual attenuation.
Yeah, Jorgensen and I were dorking out on mash temperatures and we were talking mainly about Belgians, and I was like, man, you know, my mash temperatures hardly ever go above like 148 these days. And I've realized that that's not entirely true. I'm brewing a couple pale ales recently. But even then, you know, like I read recipes and clone things and stuff, and I'm like, oh, mash at 156, you know, or mash at 158.
You're making a beer with an original gravity of 9 degrees Plato? Mash at 155, no problem.
Yeah.
You're going to get a beer that's, you'll have to do that, or it's going to be astringent, maybe, depending on your yeast.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. It's dependent on your yeast.
That is, you know, what I'm used to brewing, which is just happens to have to be really a lot, you know, more stronger. The Boundary base is kind of, we don't make weak beer.
Right.
We try to make weak beer, and we do. They make us.
Never have, Dave.
You know, honestly, what I drink the most of because it's that way. But still, it's just not natural to make a beer under 7%.
In Boundary's world, yeah. In Boundary's world, yes. And it's always been like that. I remember the golden. Do you call it the blonde now, or is it the golden?
It's the blonde ale.
It's the blonde, yeah. It used to be the golden.
Yeah, well, it did switch recently about 15 years ago to the name.
I know, yeah. I'm so on top of it. I always liked that beer.
I think it has a wonderful, subtle almond flavor to it, and I think the blonde ale is really underrated.
Yeah, yeah. It's always been one of my favorite, it's always on beers. Because for a while, I just was not drinking IPAs. It wasn't until the late hopping thing really came into.
Yeah, you were a little pissy bitch about the hoppy IPAs for a long time.
Still am.
And I was like, that's fine.
I was. And it wasn't until the people started doing the all late hop additions and lower mash temperatures to where they're super dry. I like those, and I've been brewing those and having fun with them. But
we've been doing that recently with some one-offs. We have some quarterly IPAs and stuff. And honestly, it's I'd probably brewed for almost 25 years before I brewed a beer where I added no bittering hops. And all of the hops were added in the last 15 minutes or less.
Yeah.
And when I did that, it didn't turn out like I expected. It was still much more bitter than I wanted. And I thought, wow, that is fantastic. I just learned so much from one batch of beer. It's probably the one batch of beer I learned more about than anything else. I was like, nice. Wow, yeah. you could actually just add hops right at the end and cut the boil and have the most fantastic balanced beer.
Yeah, but you have to add more, so it makes it more expensive.
Yeah, I don't buy the hops, though.
It's true.
That's Ed's job, and he loves it.
I know. Well, it makes sense. Like, I remember reading in some magazine just a few years ago, IBUs, who knew that all the late additions, you know, added all these IBUs to it, but it makes total sense. Even if you're adding it at the flame out, you still whirlpool and it still sits at 180 degrees, total isomerization level. Of course you're getting stuff out of there. Duh. But yeah, nobody really stopped to think about
it. Always so much more to learn. And so that's where it's really important when you're doing that to think about how long you whirlpool, how long you rest. I just got done doing a collaboration brew with the wonderful brewers from Iron Goat in Spokane. Mm. And their whirlpool time was the same that I like to do it, but they don't rest. And they were talking about like how the teacup thing where it goes into a funnel, but then like as if you let it rest, then it comes down. And I was thinking about it. And so I don't know, like, you know, everyone kind of does that differently. And so if you have multiple brewers doing the same recipe, but you're not doing that the same, there could be a lot of variance.
Oh, it's always, oh yeah. About no, that. I mean, brewing the same beer on a different system, in a different space, with a different shaped and sized fermenter. I mean,
always sort of had
your pitch rate
just for myself and across for all the brewers had the same sort of whirlpool and rest. It might be kind of cool to change the amount of time that you whirlpool and rest for recipe to recipe, depending on those late hop additions and how you want them to be. That's something to experiment with. Might be worth doing two batches, varying that and see what the difference is. Never done that.
Totally.
A lot of things I haven't done, but that could be a different podcast.
That's a different film.
Oh. This is not a film. Because otherwise, I would put on pants.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm too ugly to do that. I'm just wearing shorts and flip-flops.
Yeah. But you did brush your teeth. You said that.
I did.
Or no, remember you said you think you might have.
No,
brushed.
I did.
You
did. I did. Okay. Yeah, I'm feeling them now, and they're all definitely right. Not. They don't need shaving. They're good. So you've been a Boundary for a long time. You know, I mean, I was there a long time ago, and you are still there, and I have been gone a long time. So do you have... I'm hoping that since you are still in the industry that you're still in touch with a lot of different brewers and try a bunch of different stuff. Do you have a favorite brewery or like a brewing hero or somebody that you really look up to and that you really, really respect what they're doing, you know, whether they're brand new or whether they've been around forever or...
We have a new brewer at Boundary Bay. And his name is Brian Kruger.
Yeah, I know Brian.
And I guess, you know, to him, he's probably not new because he's worked there like 4 years.
Has he been there 4 years now?
Three or four
years.
Wow,
yeah.
Like maybe not quite 4 years. I don't know. I don't like, you know, put little notches on like the wall or something when I get up in the morning and go work with him.
I've gone through four sets of boots.
But he's younger. He's, you know, in his early 30s.
30s, yeah.
It's like this new breed of brewer that is just different. It's young blood. It's like we grew up brewing with Charlie Papazian's The Complete Joy of Homebrewing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like everyone who's over 40 learned to brew because of that book.
Mm-hmm.
And or their grandfather, maybe. I don't know. Right. But just like the same way, like heavy metal for us, it's like, you know, Black Sabbath, and like heavy metal is Slayer and Metallica. You know, that whole like new metal thing is just like so different. You know, the same is true with the new blood of brewing. Like there's a real cutting edge there, and he's a fantastic guy, and he's got a lot of really good ideas and just things I'd never thought about, and he's pioneered and spearheaded the our barrel program and sours, and we kind of work different schedules. So when we work together one day a week, I try to connect with him and see, you know, what he's thinking and what's going on. And he's got a lot of good ideas and just turned me on to a lot of things that I'd never thought about. And
yeah, he kind of personifies that more knowledgeable of the science of brewing.
Yeah.
Because I've talked to him a few times and was like, whoa.
Yeah, he teaches down at Skagit College, and mm-hmm. he's really connected with the Skagit Valley Malting, does a lot of speeches, and he's very intelligent, and he's got a good head for brewing, and I really enjoy working with him and seeing what he thinks about different concepts, and when I see him do something that's new, asking him why, and just, you know, learning about that. Yeah. It's really fun.
Absolutely.
I kind of feel like, you know, I'm kind of old, and like I'm just playing this stoner rock, you know, in the brewing world. And I'm like, oh yeah, cool. That's... So with like these new concepts, you got to stay. I mean, it's not like as bad as the high tech industry where every single day, if you tune
but
out,
still, you're, you know, like elite, if you open up a brewery these days, you're expected to be able to do certain things. Yeah, it's just interesting. I think not only the palates of up and coming brewers and people that are brewing, but palates of not only current customers, but up and coming customers as well. You know, just the average.
Palate's very important. We have the little off flavor tasting kits and do that every once in a while just to keep freshened up on the different off flavors and put them into our beers and sending things to the lab and having them tested. And
good. Yeah.
I think that's really important.
Nice. No, I agree. I mean, I remember reading an article with Ken Grossman from Sierra Nevada, and when Sierra Nevada started, they had no money. But the one thing that they did have was at least a little makeshift laboratory, you know, so that they knew what their yeast cell count was. They knew how clean things were. And it was always making the best quality beer that they could from the beginning.
I find that really believable that you said that. And I have always thought that the Sierra Nevada Pale Ale was the most consistent good beer that I could find in almost any
Jerkwater. You can find it in Jerkwater.
America. Yeah. Being in a traveling rock and roll band, would go on tour and we'd be in, you know, Jerkwater, Texas or something, and like they would have Sierra Nevada Pale Ale and I would order it because it was always good and I knew exactly what it was like.
Yeah. And nailing that, I mean, it's such a simple beer, but to do it really well, it's hard. Or it's not hard, but you have to pay attention to detail. So what? So we've been dorking out about beer, but obviously not everybody. I mean, I think that at this point, most people that are listening to this are in Bellingham and will know who you are. But
then they know I'm a kettle man.
Yeah, not everybody knows you. So what's something that that might surprise somebody that were to walk in and just strike up a conversation with you? Is there some, is there like one little nugget that that would be surprising that people wouldn't know about you? And it can be the worst brew day you had, the worst beer you felt you ever made, like a quirk of the brewing system, or it could be something personal.
Something
just something
different about me. Something that I think,
something that not everybody, or some that people wouldn't guess about you, or that
okay, one thing that I don't like is people are so, I don't know, institutionalized into being nice. I like it when people are honest. I love it when someone tells me how they really feel. I don't really get offended very easily. Mm-hmm. Like, just tell me some of the most best conversations and input I've had from people are people who just didn't like something and told me why, and it made me think about it.
Yeah, that's the key, though, I think, to something like that. I'm with you. I'd rather somebody told me the truth, but if you're going to have a strong opinion about something, you better be able to tell me why.
Yeah,
because otherwise you're probably just regurgitating somebody else's thoughts.
Yeah, it's the same with politics
too. Yeah, it's the same with politics.
I always get the thing like, oh, Boundary Bay, you know, I get a hangover, and I'm like, you do realize it's very strong.
Yeah, yeah.
It's because you drink beer. I was like really hungover. I'm like, yeah, but do you know how strong it is?
Don't believe the menus.
No, but really, I only had 5 IPAs. You know, you're like, do you realize?
Yeah. Record yourself and listen to that back.
There's those little cliches I've had to deal with. And I'm like, no, really. It's not Sierra Nevada Pale Ale.
Boundary's been around really so long and you've been there so long. I'm sure you've heard all of the opinions and all of the things. Let's start wrapping this up. I generally have... I do some just kind of rapid fire questions.
Okay, I'm going to stand on my chair and get ready for this.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's nothing, you know, it's not politics. It's just talking about brewing ingredients. Do you have a favorite yeast? I know you're super, super familiar with the, what is it, 1332?
And the 1056.
Yeah.
I like them both. I find that the 1056 is drier and attenuates, you know, a little better. But it has a lower flocculation rate.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of actually like that. But the 1332 is a little maltier, and I appreciate that too. I guess it just depends on what beer you're brewing. It would be nice to have really nice cell count pitches, like large quantities of pitches, to have of like every yeast just readily available.
Sure.
And I would be much more familiar with so many different yeasts. That's something that I consider myself really limited on, is that I haven't got to brew with very many kinds of yeast.
Right, right.
So I'm kind of missing out on that. My kitchen yeast is very small. It's like the compartment that we have that in the refrigerator.
Yeah.
It's very limited.
Do you have a favorite grain?
You know what? That Skagit Valley Malting is amazing grain. Yeah. Yeah. Their malt is fantastic. I brewed a bunch of beers with their malt recently, and it is just absolutely stellar.
Yeah. Robert just brewed a Saison with the Pilot Pills malt. It was wonderful.
They're Copeland Pale. Skagit Valley Malting is Copeland Pale.
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal. It is the most nutty, flavorful. I mean, I've never had a malt that just out of the palm of my hand, tossed into my mouth out of the bag while I was milling in, tastes so good like that.
Huh. Nice.
Yeah, we're so lucky to have them right in our backyard. They are world class.
Oh yeah.
And I think that if
when they're pioneering the world, stuff too, if, you know about their drums.
Yeah, I've been down there and taken a tour. And if
I haven't done that yet,
if the malting world everywhere isn't paying attention to them, then they will soon.
Yeah,
I think, yeah. They are revolutionary.
Yeah. Favorite hop?
Man, you know, my favorite hop is going to go back to one of your other questions because
okay.
It was Columbus, because mm-hmm. that goes back to, and I don't know if that's what they really used in the Bigfoot, but when I was cloning my Bigfoot and I got what I wanted out of the Columbus, and it was basically an Imperial IPA with a ton of Columbus in it.
Yeah.
That was earthy. Some darker grains. And it lent itself to a darker, maltier beer because it is that dank, earthy, musky, very, very high alpha especially for back in the day.
Right, yeah, probably 12.
You know, I've always sort of shied away from the real British hops.
Mm.
And I've tasted a lot of, you know, some of the South African hops that I'm assuming are British because they sort of colonized South
Africa. Yeah,
and
the New Zealand hops and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and they kind of have that taste. You know, my favorite hops... And it's probably going to sound really trendy. It's just the really fruity, citrusy. I've always loved the Centennial, Amarillo, Simcoe, Mosaic, Citra. You know, those are great. I love those. Those lend themselves very well to the pale ales, lighter, fresher, just refreshing beer.
Mm-hmm.
But the Columbus, you know, Zeus is the one you can get now. It's kind of just a
right,
very, very similar to Columbus.
I remember brewing a barley wine... homebrewing a barley wine that was all Columbus, and yep. I used a lot.
That's what I did.
And it took years for that beer to be drinkable. But I don't know. Any advice for up-and-coming brewers, home brewers, people that want to be pro brewers? Any little nugget of wisdom? Pearl of wisdom?
Yeah, get a real job.
No shit.
Oh, I don't know, man. The competition's so hard now. People are like, I want to work there. And I'm like, I don't know what to say. Like,
yeah. That's what I mean. The days of just being a good brewer and being able to walk your way in, talk your way in is over.
Yeah. You know? And I just sort of insular from working at Boundary Bay for so long, but like we hire probably from the inside, and the position starts with like starting to help can and helping to bottle and then maybe wash kegs. And if you wanted to actually get into the cellar, it could take years, and you would never have any guarantee you could even get on the brew deck.
Yeah.
So if you were graduating high school and you wanted to have a brewing career, I guess I would just say go to school. I would have never said this to anyone 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
I would
not.
Say go work at a brew pub, do whatever you can do to get your foot in the door, and then just
Keep at it. Yeah, but everybody's doing that now.
Be gung-ho, homebrew, share home brews with the brewer, with the
owner.
Move
to a smaller town.
Move to a smaller town. You know. Yeah, I just, you know, you have to want to do it. If you love it enough and you have a passion, get good at it, and it will find you. I think that's the way the universe works, is that if you deserve it and you earn it, it will come to you eventually. And if it's only as a hobby, then I guess you have to accept that too, because I have no idea where the market's going.
Yeah, who does? Nice. It's a good way to end it, I think. Is there anything you want to add?
Should I open the porter, or do you want some more of the raspberry?
I could go with porter and then a little raspberry. We'll just leave it at that. We'll just continue to drink beers.
And once we turn all this shit off, we should listen to some music.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Do you like Motorhead?
Of course.
Okay, because I was thinking Motorhead, Honey, Mozart, Mother of Love Bones. I'm kind of in the M section right now.
Well, that's good. My last name's Morales, so it'll be perfect.
Right.
All right. Well, hey, man, Aaron Smith, thanks so much.
Thank you very everybody. Much, Dave. Oh. As I said, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. And we just kept going and did exactly what we said we'd do. There were guitars and aged beers, because that's just how he rolls. Thanks to Aaron Jacob Smith for taking the time to sit down and share some stories. And if you see him, tell him he looks like Ira Glass. He loves that. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Tapped In. Tapped In is a production of Bellingham Tap Trail with content direction by Scott Pelton. I'm Dave Morales, and I'll see you around.